Support for Science Friday comes from True Green. This spring, don't wait until the weeds take over. Get a lawn you love with a tailored lawn care plan from True Green. Only True Green offers a free healthy lawn analysis. So visit True, that's TRUGreen.com/Friday today. True Green, America's number one professional lawn care company. Support for this podcast comes from Midroll. Midroll wants to continue to bring quality brands and valued product offers to your attention, but they need your input. So please go to podcastsurvey.com/science and take a quick anonymous survey that will help Midroll get to know you a little better. Even if you've taken our show's podcast listener survey before, the current one is new and different, so I'd really appreciate it if you took it all over again. Plus, once you've completed the survey, you can enter to win a $100 Amazon gift card. So just go to podsurvey.com/science. That's podsurvey.com/science. And thanks for your help. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Late last year, archaeologists digging up an ancient village belonging to the Heiltsuk First Nation in British Columbia painstakingly excavated a few flakes of charcoal from what once had been a hearth. They sent the charcoal out for an analysis that would reveal its age, and the number they got back shocked them. That village, abandoned since a smallpox epidemic in the late 1800s, isn't just old. It turns out that it's as much as 14,000 years old. That's three times as old as the pyramids at Giza. And while that number doesn't make it the absolute oldest in North America, it does make it one of the older sites, and it adds more fodder for a question that archaeologists and anthropologists have been puzzling over for many years. The first people to arrive in North America, did they travel inland through a corridor of land free from the Ice Age glaciers, or did they cross the Bering Strait and follow the shoreline in boats and find more welcoming places to settle? What's called the kelp highway hypothesis. Also pondering those questions is my guest, who's been working on the site at Tri-Kit. Alicia Gavereau, a scholar with the Hakai Institute and PhD candidate, University of Victoria in British Columbia. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello.
So this site is three times as old as the pyramids. What's that in the context of habitation of North America?
Well, there are, as you said just a moment ago, there are several sites that date to around the same time as the very early date that we obtained for Tri-Kit Island. So what this is suggesting is just that people have been here for, you know, tens of thousands of years, which really, I think, what's so exciting about that for the general public is that, well, in particular in terms of celebrating Canada's history of 150 years, it just puts into perspective how long people have actually been here.
Well, the island has been constantly occupied even when the rest of Canada was covered in ice. How did that happen?
That's quite right. So this occurred as a result of what we are calling a sea level hinge, and this was identified by Duncan McLaren and crew a few years ago through modeling and coring of the Hakai region. And so due to the sea level hinge, the sea level remained relatively stable in this area for that entire time, so since the end of the late glacial maximum. So all the rest of the landmass was covered in ice. As those ice sheets started to recede, and, you know, we had some major shifts in sea levels coastwise, so further to the north and to the south, in the magnitude of 150 to 200 meters of difference, whereas here it remained exactly the same. So people were able to return to this island repeatedly over time.
The Tri-Kit Island site is in the territory of the Heiltsuk Indigenous Group. William Housty is on the board of directors of the Heiltsuk Integrated Resource Management Department. We talked to him by phone earlier this week, and he said the find matches what the Heiltsuk have been saying about their history for thousands of years.
Our oral history talks about how in that particular area around Tri-Kit Island was one of the only areas in our territory that wasn't covered by the ice during the Ice Age. So the people flocked there for survival because everywhere else was being covered by ice and all the ocean was freezing and all the food resources were dwindling. So in the end, it was, you know, the group of people that were able to survive the Ice Age survived right there, around Trichet Island, and now to have this archaeological evidence saying the same thing is pretty powerful.
And the Heltzuk pointed you to this dig in the first place?
We have been working with the community members in the Heltzuk Integrated Resource Management Department since around 2012, and indeed we confer with them, and we engage in the exchange of knowledge and knowledge building and sharing and that sort of thing to help direct us, yes, indeed, in terms of which areas are likely to have cultural deposits.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of artifacts are you finding? What did they say about how the people on Trichet Island lived and who they were?
Right. So the artifact collection is quite impressive due to the preservation characteristics of the sediments on Trichet, due to the peat deposits in particular. And of course, analyses are ongoing, but some of the neato artifacts, stone tools, include utilized obsidian microblades and flake tools, a graphite nodule, as well as groundstone tools. Wooden artifacts include atlatls and spear throwers. So spear thrower.
Wow.
Board, fragments of fish hooks, a hand drill for starting fires, carved wooden bipoints of various lengths, and a very curious faceted wooden bowl, as well as a fragment of a carved wrap stick. And I could go on, but basically all of these things, coupled with the faunal assemblage, tell us that the earliest people were making relatively simple stone tools at first, perhaps expediently, due to the parent material that was available at the time. They were also pursuing sea mammal by watercraft. They were gathering shellfish, and later they engaged in trade or traveled great distances to procure specific materials for specialized stone tool production, so those obsidian microblades and flakes, as well as greenstone and the graphite as well. In later times, it seems as though it shifted more towards a focus on rockfish and herring and lingcod, that sort of thing.
So these were a seagoing people, and does this add to the kelp theory hypothesis that the early North Americans came over by boat?
Well, it certainly adds evidence to the fact that people were able to travel by boat in that coastal area by watercraft, because, as mentioned before, the sea level has been relatively the same. That would have been the only way to get out to Trichet Island. And it also really just shows how masterful and experienced sea travelers these people would have been on this very in order to get out to this very exposed outer coastal island as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Heltzuk routinely negotiate with the Canadian government on management of natural resources, governance of their territory, negotiations that rely in part on their record of inhabiting that territory over a long period of time. Here's William Housty again.
Up until about 30 years ago, all this information was transmitted through speech, right? There was no records of any of this oral history. So when we're at the table with our oral history, it's like me telling you a story and you have to believe me without seeing any evidence. So you have to trust me that I'm telling you the truth, which isn't always the easiest thing to do, especially when you're dealing with government. So now that we can go to the table with the government in negotiations, we can have not only our oral history, but we could also have the archaeological evidence and the data from Western science to say, hey, what these stories are saying are actually verified, are actually true, that they're actually dovetailing together to tell a really powerful tale. So that's really going to be very significant and going to give us I think will definitely give us a leg up in negotiations for sure.
Mm-hmm. And I would imagine, Dr. Gavro, that this partnership with the Heltzuk also benefit archaeologists.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, in terms of the knowledge sharing and then the insight that we can have in terms of the interpretation of our various natural and cultural deposits that we're interacting with, for sure.
Do we know that that maybe they migrated off the island to other places too?
Well, there are other sites on the coast. So Namoon nearby has a basal date of about 11,000 years before present, and then as well there is the footprint site that is also being investigated through the Hakai Ancient Landscapes Archaeology Project, which has a date of about 13,000 years ago. So yes, indeed, there would have been some island hopping in this area. But Trichet Island, unlike those other locations, that very early date that we have is stratigraphically below the other deposits that date to around 11,500, all the way up to 5,000 years ago, and then continuing on. So they were definitely sticking around Trichet Island longer than anywhere else.
Hey, that's amazing. Okay, let's talk about the next questions to answer about this site and about early North American people as a whole. What would you like to know, and how would you like to find it? If you had a blank check and you could, you know, spend any amount of money that you can, what would you like to do with it?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I'd like to do environmental DNA analysis at the site, because you are able to pick up traces of species. So in terms of more in-depth faunal analysis as well, because you're not just looking for the bones, but also those chemical signatures in the soil, showing what is actually in those sediments. In addition to that, what were those impacts of the tsunami events on the people living there, and how can we come to evaluate that, as well as, you know, what does this historical ecology of the island tell us about climate and subsistence cycles more broadly, as well as what this data can tell us about, you know, to inform stewardship policies and resource management mm-hmm. more broadly, as well as specific to that region. I'm also really interested in just in using the data from Tricket Island to better understand these existing theories of change and more importantly, continuity. So again, why are people returning to this place over and over again and staying there for prolonged periods of time? And of course, the Heltzik can have spoken about that, and William has shared a bit about why it's such an important area as well.
Did the Heltzik survive continuously? Do you have data for that? Or would the DNA tell you that, if you could use it?
The environmental DNA would tell us about the subsistence use, surely, and then the environment more broadly. We haven't done any genetic testing with the community. That is an ongoing discussion. Of course, there are other studies that have been done coast-wide that have investigated that sort of thing. But, yes, not at this point in time.
Are you having any luck raising the money to do these things that you'd like to do?
Well, all of our work is currently supported by the Hakai Institute and Tula Foundation, and this project has been ongoing for about 5 years. And they also provide, you know, the infrastructure and other support through the Hakai staff. And indeed, we are very open to collaborating with other researchers and outsourcing some of the analyses where appropriate. I've also applied for a SHRC grant, so waiting to hear back about that as well.
Well, we wish you luck. It's quite an interesting find, and thank you for sharing everything you've learned on it.
Thanks so much, Ira. It's very exciting.
Alicia Gavreau, a scholar with the Hakai Institute and a PhD candidate at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. I think she's going to get that PhD after this one. We're going to take a break, and coming up, tapping into the creative abilities of people with disorders like dyslexia and autism, their challenges and also their strengths. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. Science Friday is supported by Halo Top Creamery. We got the best package that made our day. The folks at Halo Top Creamery sent over a box with all 17 flavors of their ice cream, and we had a little ice cream social. There was every flavor from red velvet and s'mores to vanilla bean and mint chip here. My favorite was pistachio. That ice cream reminded me of the great pistachio flavor I had growing up. I wanted to eat the whole pint, but others had their spoons ready too. And the great part is, Halo Top ice cream is only around 300 calories per pint. I'm saying per pint. Pints for other ice cream brands are like 1,000 calories, right? So Halo Top is way less, and it still tastes great. Plus, they use only the best all-natural ingredients, so it feels like you're eating something that's good and good for you. But just don't take our word for it. Dig in and see for yourself just how good healthy ice cream can be. Head over to halotop.com to find a pint near you, and check them out on social media at Halo Top Creamery. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Plato. The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the famous DSM, is a tool that psychiatrists use to help diagnose and treat mental illnesses. It divides them into categories like major depressive disorder, autism, bipolar disorder, dyslexia. Each one describes the way in which something is abnormal about a person's behavior, as if something has gone wrong with the wiring in their brain. Well, that approach to mental illness, right versus wrong, normal versus abnormal, doesn't sit well with my next guest. In her latest book, she recasts brain disorders as brain differences, ones that come with some tough challenges, but also unique abilities. Gail Saltz is a clinical associate professor of psychiatry at New York Presbyterian Hospital, author of the new book, The Power of Different, The Link Between Disorder and Genius. And she joins us in our New York studio. Welcome, Science Friday.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
You describe disorders as brain differences. How is that different than a normal description?
Well, currently, I think, we categorize based on behaviors, a group of behaviors. We say this is a reflection of a disease that causes suffering, and that is true. But we categorize it in very discrete boxes to the best of our ability. I mean, the advantages of doing this, the reasons for doing this have to do with talking to insurance companies, for clinicians to talk to each other, to think about prognosis. But unfortunately, those boxes don't really fit. And clinicians, in truth, most clinicians, when they're treating people, are really treating symptoms. And we don't know for certain what each of these symptoms means in terms of wiring in the brain. And actually, what it may turn out to be, and it's looking like from lots of projects that are ongoing right now in terms of MRIs and looking at the brain, is that there's a tremendous variation in wiring in the brain. We all, to some degree, have differences. And it's a matter of how different the difference is, if you will, whether you are going to be suffering symptoms as a result of that. But what I also think is important, because stigma related to these diagnoses keeps people from getting treatment, or from even acknowledging what's going on, and also from knowing that the very difference that may be causing you suffering is also correlated to a very particular strength, depending on what that suffering or difference
is. Give
me
an idea, for example.
For example, people with dyslexia may really struggle in school and with reading and suffer as a result, but they also likely have a very particular strength in spatial relations ability, visual spatial abilities, in pattern recognition, in perception on the periphery of their vision. There are very particular things that lend themselves to extraordinary strengths. For example, I profile in the book a Dr. Beryl Benesaraf, who is a physician with pretty severe dyslexia that really has caused her struggling. But at the same time, her ability to see on x-rays certain things that other people really cannot see as a result of these visual spatial abilities means that she went on to discover how one can diagnose Down syndrome in utero by ultrasound. That is her discovery, a huge contribution to the field, really, because she has dyslexia.
And the same might be said for people with autism or people with bipolar.
Correct. So specifically in autism, not to diminish the suffering because it's substantial, but for people, for example, with mild to moderate autism, what is perseveration and a problem sometimes behaviorally means a repetition of certain things with an exactness of that repetition that makes them able to do certain jobs, certain tasks better than people that don't have that. And they also have something called hypersystemization, the ability to fit things into categories, classify objects in a way that, again, think Steve Wozniak, allow them to do things better than people who do not have this issue. And yes, that's true of various mood disorders, anxiety disorders, attentional issues, as you brought up.
Mm-hmm. And is it possible, like we say, that people with autism have a spectrum disorder? Is it possible that all of the disorders are sort of a spectrum? They
yes.
range along, and then we just put them in one big box.
So, yes, first of all, it's going to turn out to be that these big boxes are going to be many boxes, if you will, that there are going to be many disorders that are autism. However, it is also true, and I think this brings up an important point, all of these diagnoses are really, in a way, normal behaviors that have moved so far out on the continuum as to impair functioning. So guess what? We all are sad sometimes. We all are anxious sometimes. We all have better or not as good social relating abilities at times. But when it becomes more extreme and impairs functioning, that's when we start to call it a, quote, disorder.
Mm-hmm. Talking with Gail Saltz, author of The Power of Different, The Link Between Disorder and Genius, in case you joined us late. You say it's not a coincidence that many people with creative abilities also have these differences. What research is there to support that?
Yes, well, it's really fascinating. First of all, it's important to understand I am talking about, and the data talks about, this U-shaped curve, the idea that if you have something very severe on one end of the curve, you might not manifest these things because probably you're impaired enough that it, even if you have it in your mind, in your brain, you might not be able to show it or organize it well enough to make it come to fruition. But for mild to moderate on that U-shaped curve, yes. The data show, for instance, in the arts, and in the sciences, but particularly in the arts and music and all writing, et cetera, there's a very high preponderance of extreme creativity. It's not to say that people who are, quote, normal can't be highly creative. They often are. But it is to say that people who are actually mild to moderately, quote, mentally ill, have a higher likelihood of being highly creative than people who don't have a mental illness. And I think that's really important. If you look back in time at the iconic geniuses of history, the Hemingways, the Van Goghs, the Abraham Lincolns, the Albert Einsteins, you will have a hard time finding someone who did not have a mental illness or a learning disability.
In fact, you say in your book that if you removed all those people with bipolar disorder from the arts and creative fields,
you wouldn't have any. I mean, it really is striking. And, you know, scientists don't like to talk about striking and anecdotal things. And right. I agree right. with that. But the correlations are quite high. And I think we don't yet have the science to explain it all. But it is clearly, clearly there.
All right. Let's see if we can go to the phones. Let's go to Renee in Cleveland. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Ira. How are you?
Hi there. Go ahead.
I was wondering, as a high school teacher, what are some ways that I can help my students who already feel so stigmatized by a diagnosis to help them understand that it's not necessarily, you know, the end of the world for them to have dyslexia, for them to have learning disability? You know, what tools do you have to offer me to offer my students to help them through that kind of thing?
Thank you so much for asking that question. It's something I really address in the book because the educational system is very uniform and children are expected to jump through every hoop. And as we're talking about, some have weaknesses in certain areas, but also what they don't know is they have strength. So their self-esteem suffers. So first, you want to help that child identify their strengths. As an educator, you may really be privy to that. If you're not, you might suggest testing, neuropsych testing, to help them do that. But if you see that a child has an area of strength, you really want to fan that flame. You want to give them as much work in that arena so that they, and give them the feedback. Hey, yes, you do struggle with this, but wow, you really have a strength here. And if you can offer projects that play to that strength, so where there is variability or where there is flexibility in being able to say, for this project, I would like you to do it in this way so that you can, for example, use your visual spatial relations or use your more of an auditory learner. You're going to do it this way. To offer them the chance to show where they're strong, because while you can tell them they shouldn't feel bad, the reality is society still stigmatizes this so much that just saying that won't help. But showing them, by allowing them to blossom in the areas where they have ability and to fan the flame of their passion, where they will then continue to repeat something and get better at it, that's, as an educator, what you can really do.
Okay, Renee, thanks for calling.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Well, let's go to a lot of people interested. Let's go to Chris in Florida. Hi, Chris. Welcome to Science Friday.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment when I heard your guest speak about a physician that was able to spot x-rays and had a learning disability related to dyslexia. I kind of share a common thread in that my background is in mechanical engineering, and I guess my gift looking back through my career, has been able to troubleshoot machinery that other mechanics and other engineers have struggled with. So I can basically take apart a machine and figure out kind of what went wrong much, much easier and much more readily than kind of the average mechanic and the average engineer.
And why is
that's
that?
That's kind of helped me in my career.
Is that because you have dyslexia?
I was diagnosed in fourth grade with dyslexia and got kind of after school help to help overcome that, and even today, you know, when I'm really tired, it'll kind of come back to me. I'll transpose a number. If you know, give me a phone number over the phone, I may do the 6-9. I go 9-6, but Generally, I've kind of overcome it, but you know, people think about this, learning disabilities and in particular dyslexia as a handicap. It's actually been a bonus for me. It's excelled in my career as a mechanical engineer. It probably drifted my mind and my thoughts more towards math and science, but it's resulted in a very rewarding and helpful career.
Thank you, Chris.
You know, it's a common story. It's just that people aren't usually talking about it. And it brings up an important point, which is you do want to treat people or help them develop the workarounds for the thing that is the relative weakness for them. So I don't want to minimize the importance of that he was taught methods to cope with so that he could, you know, function in the world. And sometimes it still is a problem, but for the most part, he's developed these workarounds. But it does, if you get treatment or a workaround, it does not diminish the strength.
Well, that was my question.
That's the important thing.
I mean, if you give medication to people, mm-hmm. do they not want it because they realize they're more creative?
So in the arena where that tends to happen the most is in bipolar disorder, where people who recognize that when they're hypomanic on the elevated side, they are highly creative. And they're right, by the way. That is the time. They are highly creative and highly productive. They're afraid to take medication because they think it will ruin that. And what I would say to them is this, speaking with all of the experts, while it might take it down, you know, 5%, it still will be better than normal, let's say. And it's more important to maintain a stable trajectory because no one stays hypomanic. They either mm-hmm. become manic, psychotic, or very depressed. And in those two states, you cannot take your creativity and bring it to fruition. So it is important. And it doesn't rob you of the creativity. It might just take the very tippy peak out.
If other psychiatrists adopt your philosophy and look at these as brain differences, is it going to change the way that they treat their patients?
I think that only slightly. I think most psychiatrists, they're of course, someone comes in with a problem, they're there to treat that problem, and I agree with that. But I do think that it will change the view of a patient, and I think that is important. I think it's important for society, where we're still stigmatizing and keeping people from getting treatment in that way. But I think that if a clinician can help a patient to identify their strengths in addition to treating their weaknesses, that changes that person's life. That will help that person mm-hmm. to find vocation, to find pleasure, to find self-esteem, because it's very hard when someone comes in for treatment to help them with the portion of this that is about feeling abnormal or bad.
Mm-hmm. Talking with Gail Saltz, author of The Power of Different, The Link Between Disorder and Genius, on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. A lot of folks want to get in on the conversation. Let's stay in Florida to Jacksonville. Go to Sarah. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Hi there. Go ahead.
First-time caller, long-time listener.
First-time, long-time. Great. Go ahead.
My question for Gail is, let me start over. I'm a graphic designer, been in the industry for many years, and one of the things I've noticed is that my creativity started very early, and I have the ability to notice the variances, the very small detailed variances in the color spectrum, and I'm able to put them into order. I've taken those tests before, and I score very high on that, as well as, for example, I can notice when things are off by a few pixels when you blow it up several hundred percent. yeah. I also should mention at this point that I do live with OCD and anxiety disorder. And my question for Gail is, should I owe my thanks to my creative abilities to those disorders?
So that's an understandable and excellent question. And this is what I would say. What I found is that people with anxiety disorders and OCD being in there have incredible attention to detail. They are what is called hypervigilant for all the good of that mm-hmm. and all the bad of that. So obviously,
yeah,
if
exactly.
you are scanning everything for everything, and it might be a warning signal or a danger signal, mm-hmm. on the downside, you know, you're anxious a lot and you are perfectionistic, and you can feel badly about what you can't, anything that gets in your way, as it were. On the upside, yes, people often with anxiety disorders are, you know, super competent in terms of this hypervigilance really do see nuance, see it coming from far away, are vigilant not only about details like you're describing in terms of, you know, color spectrum, but also emotionally vigilant, see in other people when something is coming down the pike emotionally and are able to sort of step in and circumvent something that's coming along in the arena you're talking about, but also in relationships. And so, you know, might that have contributed? Yes, it really might contribute. Now, I would tell you that when you are on the high end of anxiety or OCD, you should absolutely treat that, because there's a sweet spot of you've heard of performance anxiety, right?
Yeah.
Athletes who do the best when they are somewhat anxious.
Kind of treatment are you talking about?
So for both anxiety disorders and OCD, various forms of cognitive behavioral therapy, exposure therapy are extremely useful, work very well. Some people for whom, you know, they're really suffering and it's very difficult might benefit from added medication. But some people can do well with therapy alone. And for some people, even a psychodynamic psychotherapy can be helpful in anxiety disorders.
One last question. I got about a minute to go. What do you think about getting rid of these categories altogether in the DSM, throwing away the DSM?
So I think we continue to need a language just because of culturally the way our system is set up. But what I do think is that at some point we will be getting rid of the DSM, but it will be replaced by something else, something that is more symptom-based and more neurologically based. So we will start to, this Connectome project, which is wrapping up and looking at 12,000 normal brains under MRI, is going to have a lot to say about variation, and I think it will help us recategorize.
Gail Saltz, author of The Power of Different, The Link Between Disorder and Genius. Great, great book. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Water. It's the one thing they're not making any more of. Fresh water is precious, so people are always looking for novel ways of finding fresh water. And now scientists at MIT have designed a device that can extract 3 liters of water vapor from the air, even really sort of dry air. Humidity as low as 20%, and it uses the climate's most abundant resource to do it, the sun. Wow. Joining us to talk about her new water widget is Dr. Evelyn Wang, Associate Professor of Mechanical Engineering at MIT. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Wang.
Hi, Ira. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Can you give us a little thumbnail sketch of how your device works, even in such low humidity conditions?
Sure. The device works based on a really special material called the metal organic framework, and that has been developed by my collaborator at UC Berkeley, Professor Omar Yagi. And the key to this material is the fact that it can capture a lot of water from the air. And so you can tailor these types of materials in that way such that it can really soak up a lot of that water. And the key then is, once you capture the water with this material, then how do you actually extract it from that and then make it into drinking water?
I was going to ask you why the water vapor is attracted to the material to begin with.
Right. It has a lot of special kind of features of the material itself. First of all, it's kind of this three-dimensional porous type framework. And the way you design these materials, in particular, this one has these zirconium metal clusters with these organic linkers, and it creates this kind of very porous metal frame, this framework that has a lot of surface area that particularly attracts the water molecules and doesn't attract as well, say, CO2.
Mm-hmm.
In this way, it's really great in terms of soaking up or capturing the water. However, an important part is then releasing also this water, right? There are a lot of materials that are really good at capturing water and a lot of that water. However, this material is also nicely tailored such that you can release the water relatively easily with very little energy and at low temperatures. And that's why we can use the sunlight in this case to do that, to be able to now extract the water and then condense it back from the vapor to the liquid phase in this particular device.
What does the sunlight do? We're not thinking of a solar cell here making electricity, are we?
No, in this case, we're thinking more of like a solar thermal type process. So in fact, the sun is allowing you to heat up this material. And typically, when you think about how much sunlight there is, it can't heat up material that much. But that's enough, in particular for this material, to now release the water molecules from the surface and then allow it to condense with a condenser design.
How big is this? Is it bigger than a bread box, as we say? It looks like about the size of a bread box.
It is about, you know, I would say that's exactly the size of our prototype right now. It's kind of more of a proof of concept type prototype in that this kind of approach to harvesting water can work.
How much water? Right? How much water can it harvest?
So this device, I would say, is not something in terms of large quantities. So because the amount of material we use is about a gram type scale. So you can imagine that based on the numbers, it's only a fraction of a gram type water, right? But when we're thinking about really creating an actual practical device, as you mentioned, these numbers of about 3 liters per day, you know, we can start to think about actually incorporating many layers of this type of material into a more practical type configuration, and such that you can, in fact, extract a reasonable amount of water, say about 3 liters per day in a typical size scale, as you suggest, of like, say, a bread box.
Wow. How common are 20% humidity environments in the areas that need better sources of drinking water?
So we've looked at the world map, and you can see that, in fact, there are many regions in say, Africa as well as India. There are a lot of arid-type conditions all over the map that we're trying to target this type of technology where there is also abundant sun. And in a lot of these regions, obviously the infrastructure is very limited, so there aren't really many approaches that can really address the water scarcity problem. And really the opportunity that we have with our technology is the fact that it can be completely passive, right?
Wow.
So as long as we have sunlight and we have this material in this kind of design device, we can now have clean drinking water.
Have you gone out and tested it in the desert yet?
We have not. In fact, that has been really our next target, is really taking our prototype out now and going to different target areas within the U.S. as well as elsewhere around the world that really could benefit from this kind of technology.
All right. So who's got the patent on this one, and who's going to buy the patent to work with you on that?
That's a good question. So the materials are very special, and the materials patents belong to my collaborator at Berkeley, Omar Yagi. And we have a patent for the design of the types of devices that you can make from using these materials.
So it's a lot of different. It's not just that little bread box. You could come up with all kinds of different designs for this.
That's right. And I think there's a lot of kind of nuances to be able to maximize the kind of output of the water that you want, right? And so, for example, you know, we have these special materials, but they're incorporated into a matrix that's made of a metal. So it's actually a copper foam matrix that we have this material in. The reason we do that is because an important part of this is, in fact, the heat transport, because when we shine the sun on this material, the material itself, the metal organic framework, has a relatively low thermal conductivity. And so you can have a pretty large temperature gradient across the material, and so it takes a lot longer to be able to remove the water molecules and to actually be able to then collect it in the form of liquid. And so by incorporating this kind of metal matrix within it, then enhances the overall kind of heat transfer processes such that it can more easily kind of remove the water. Mm. And we can design the kind of the geometries of the layers such that we can maximize that kind of extraction process of the water.
So when might we see the first one out there ready?
We hope that we can see really like more of a real practical device in the next couple years or so. That's what we're aiming for. So we're really hoping whether we take this technology out as a startup or, you know, we'll work with other kind of companies that can help us kind of take it to the market and to really make it a product. That's what we're hoping.
Well, good luck to you. And we'll wait to get the first one online somewhere.
Great. Thanks a lot, Ira.
Dr. Evelyn Wang, Associate Professor of Mechanical Engineering at MIT. One of the first lessons you're taught in school is how to tie your shoelace. There's the ever-popular bunny ear technique, and then there's the one-loop-around method. I hate to break it to you, but there is a wrong way and a right way to tie your shoes, or at least strong and weak way to create your shoelace knot. But even if you know how to create a strong knot, your shoelaces eventually, well, they're going to become untied. It's enough to make you consider Velcro. Forbid. So why do our shoelaces become untied? That simple question has some very interesting science behind it, and a group of researchers investigated just that. The study was published this week in the journal Proceedings of the Royal Society A. Christine Gregg is one of the authors on that study. She's also a graduate student in mechanical engineering at UC Berkeley. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. You know, a lot of us have been tying our shoes wrong this whole time. Can you explain how you tie a strong knot versus a weak one?
Yeah, sure. So the standard bow tie knot that most people use on their shoes has a weak form and a strong form. The strong form is based on what's called a reef knot or a square knot, whereas the weak form is based on what most people call a granny knot. And so it has to do with the handedness and sort of after you tie that first crisscross, what you do after that determines whether you're going to get the strong version or the weak version.
Mm. So, if you could you wind up with the square knot, you get a little stronger version. Does this apply to the bunny ears method too?
Yeah, you can definitely get both with the bunny ears, as well as doing the one loop and then going around.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell us about the question you wanted to answer. You want to answer the question every kindergarten and adult asks. Why do our shoelaces become untied during the day? How did you go about answering that question?
Yeah, so we had this problem. My co-authors and I, Christopher Daly Diamond and Oliver O'Reilly, we couldn't figure out why our shoelaces were constantly becoming untied. And so we started to look into it on Google, and we couldn't find anyone who had actually described the mechanism of what's happening on your shoe. So I jumped on the treadmill, and Chris filmed me with a really nice slow-motion camera, high-speed camera, and we saw this amazing sort of dynamic interaction between the swinging of your leg that's causing these all sorts of inertial forces on the free ends and loops and the impact force of your foot on the ground.
Hmm. And what did you find?
Yeah, so again, it's that 1-2 punch of having these really strong inertial forces and the impact. We studied just, I would sit on a table and I would just swing my legs back and forth to see if you could just get it by swinging your legs. And you couldn't, and neither could you get it to untie if you just stamped your foot. You really need both. So as you bring your foot forward, you're accelerating your laces and their inertia forces kind of pull them forward. And at the same time, you have this impact force that's serving to loosen the center of the knot. And so eventually, you're going to get loose enough so that the friction forces can't hold on to that lace and keep it in the center of the knot. And so the inertial forces are going to start tugging on that free end of your loop, just like you if you were trying to untie it with your hand.
So the pounding you do with your feet loosens the knot, and then the action of swinging as you swing your foot makes the knot itself sort of move and unties it.
Right. And it's this interesting, we noticed in the video that your knot will be fine for, hundreds, thousands of cycles, and it's only in about 1 or 2 strides that it comes undone. And that's because you have these competing forces of the free end inertia and the loop inertia. And so it's this positive feedback loop of once you get a little bit of motion, yeah, it's all over. It just comes undone.
Yeah, I know what that's like. But most of us, we put double knots on our shoes, right? Doesn't that help?
It certainly helps. Oliver, complains that even his double knotted laces still come untied. So we didn't specifically study those, so I can only offer limited commentary.
I'm Myra Flato. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Christine Gregg, a graduate student at UC Berkeley, who has studied shoelace science. So the average lifespan of a shoelace knot, we don't know. It could just come apart with the right bang on the ground.
There are so many factors. There's, what size your laces are, what they're made out of, how tightly did you tie it in the first place. But I can tell you that the strong knot will last you at least twice as long as the weak one.
And actually the shape of the shoelace. Now I remember when I back in the day when I had fancy shoes, I don't wear them much anymore. They used to have these very skinny round shoelaces that never stayed closed.
Yeah,
they're like strings, stringy things, you know.
Absolutely. So those are the ones that we actually used in the study, because if you're trying to study shoelaces coming untied, you better choose laces that want to come untied. But we definitely want to look into, you know, are different shapes going to serve you better, and all the different variables that go into it.
Mm. Now, you know, I know there are people, and you sit down and having a beer sometime, you talk. Believe me, I've gotten around to talking about shoelace knots before, and people have commented about the knot, where the knot is placed on the shoe. Some people say, look, you have your knot tied all the way to the side. Other people have it tied straight in the middle. Is there a difference in the strength or the durability of that spot?
You know, we didn't study that specifically. Again, we were trying to just describe the basic mechanism and control just the thousands of variables that could go into it. But keep in mind that it depends on what sort of your inertial forces are and how those forces are acting. So I imagine that the placement can at least have a subtle effect on that.
Yeah, is there any application in real life for this? I mean, understanding your shoelace is not science.
Well, I'd say it's primarily applicable in real life. I use it every day. But
so what do you do? Okay, now you have the knowledge. How do you keep your shoelaces from untying?
My life has been changed by the strong version of the knot, I'll tell you that much. But really, you know, to your actual question, what makes a certain knot stronger than another and better able to withstand forces is still an open question in science. At this point, we can't look at just any given knot and say, oh, the structure of this one has these characteristics, and so it should be better at resisting force than another. And so we see our work as sort of an open invitation for collaboration in the field and trying to make progress on understanding what is it about knots that makes them strong. And if you understand that, you can start to do anything from understanding surgical sutures to understanding how perhaps other entangled structures like DNA self-interact.
Interesting, because I know as a former Boy Scout doing a lot of knots, I know there are some knots that actually get tighter as you try to loosen them. And they're better at that.
Absolutely. Right. And so right now, you know, we have hundreds of years to work with of sort of heuristic data of, you know, well, we know this one performs a lot better. And so we're trying to dig into, you know, being able from a scientific standpoint to predict the behavior of certain knots based only on their structure.
All right. Let me see if I can get a quick call from Mimi in Birmingham, Alabama. Hi, Mimi. Quickly.
Hey, how are you?
Fine.
And someone taught me years ago when my kids were little, if I would tie a knot and make one loop with the string around the knot that you're holding and another loop, in other words, two loops to tie it and then push it through and pull it, that it will never come undone. And I have found that to be true, and my kids are now 58 and 56.
Thank you, Mimi. I got to go. I've seen this also pushed back on the internet. You make two loops instead of that one round around the loop. Have you thought of that one?
Sure. Absolutely. I mean, that's just another knot that, you know, we're looking to understand. We stuck with the sort of the basic knot that most people are tying. But again, you know, we think the mechanism that's those forces that are pulling on it are going to be the same no matter what that knot is.
Wow.
But again, you know, it's still an open question of, you know, what is it about that extra loop that's making it so much stronger?
Well, the forces are with us even when we tie our shoes. Thank you, Christine. Christine Gray, graduate student, mechanical engineering, UC Berkeley. One last thing. If you enjoyed our segment about wildflowers a few weeks ago, the wild desert bees buzzed about this year's super bloom. Well, now's your chance to tag along with bee biologists hunting for those wild pollinators. We have photos and a video up at sciencefriday.com/bees. That's sciencefriday.com/bees. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. If you're celebrating Easter this weekend, happy Easter.